learn in case you'd like to download them and take notes on your own devices. I don't know if your professor mentioned it to you, but he and his wife are expecting their first baby this week. So you will be having some guest lectures by our teaching assistants, myself on Tuesday, discussing stress and emotion. The professor was like, would you like to lecture on stress? And I was like, oh, am I the expert now? So I guess I am. I guess we all are, right? So your other TA, Saul, will be lecturing on learning and memory with a special focus on neuroaesthetics and pleasure, which is exciting. So you guys get stressed out here and then you get the fun on Thursday. All right, so if you guys have any questions about the content I am teaching you, please raise your hand. I am open to intrusions and interruptions. I love them. I'll also be kind of, you know, asking some questions of you as well throughout the process. If you feel shy and can't ask questions during lecture, please feel free to come to my office hours on Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. Pacific time. And they're over Zoom, but you can also email me and make an appointment for in-person office hours. And I'm right in the psychology building, like right around where we have our sections in Pritzker Hall. Alrighty. So before we get going, I just want to, actually I'm going to flip forward here. I just want to give you guys a little orientation of where we are and where we're going. So we took the midterm, you guys did wonderfully, the average was pretty high. Last week we discussed vision and visual perception last Tuesday. Last Thursday we discussed biological rhythms, sleep, and dreaming. This week we'll be discussing emotion and stress. Thursday is learning and memory. I want to talk about next Tuesday, because I got some issues with the way in which our Jeopardy was done. I feel like my sections were in the back. I feel like Juan Luis was biased. But don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. You know, the whale and squid team, I know you got it. But, like, you know, we've got some other teams, like the seashell and the puffins, that may re-challenge you next Tuesday. So be prepared. It's going to be the same design. We'll be doing the sort of quiz five will be in your sections this week. It'll be discussing the material or testing the material from last week, so vision, biological rhythms, etc. Quiz six will be on this week's material. It'll occur during the review session, that combined discussion session next week. So cry face, this week will be the last time that your TAs will see you in discussion section. There will be no discussion section next week. Then next Thursday is going to be your final exam during class time, so in person during class time. A little word about the final exam. It's cumulative and it's not cumulative. I know that's annoying when I say yes and no. What that means is that you need the foundations prior to the midterm to understand what comes next in the next modules. For example, there's no way you could have understood how vision and the signaling is done through hyperpolarization unless we went through electrical signaling in the nervous system. So, you know, that being said, it will be, you know, more, there will be some questions from the foundational material, but it will be oriented towards, you know, the more recent modules. So it is cumulative and it's not cumulative. Okay, so, and then, you know, next week's quiz will be on this week's material. Any questions on logistics, you know, all the sort of nuts and bolts before we continue? All right, we're all feeling confident. Feel free to interrupt me. So, you know, just to see where we are, you've done the midterm, you know, you've done 4 out of 6 of the quizzes. You can drop your lowest one or get extra credit for that 6th one. You can get extra credit for the syllabus quiz. Also, another way you can get extra credit is by doing the evaluations. Now, I know there was some conversation on the GroupMe about the evaluations. Not only will it get you points, but please, please, please be my best friend. Do my evaluations. And the reason why is because even if they're poor, then I will receive appropriate training to get better. And if they're good, I will receive the things I need to continue with my job. So they're really helpful to me. They're really essential for people like me who are, you know, like trying, you know, just trying to rise up in this world. Okay, so I want to go over, there was a question in the GroupMe on the previous material. I have two big questions that I just wanted to address on last week that I'd like to go over so we feel confident going into this week's material. One question was the anatomy of the retina. This is one of the things I presented in my section saying, like, these are like one of the two or three things that are backwards in the visual system. Backwards, meaning that these cells, if you look at them under a microscope, they're so translucent, you can barely see them. You can see the nuclei a little bit. Sometimes in certain like microscope settings, you can see some of like the sort of projections, but they're very translucent. So the light will go through the retina. It'll go right through these cells. And the pigmented epithelium is kind of like a mirror. It mirrors back the light. So if you've ever seen, some people in my section have heard this before, if you've ever seen a cat at night and the light shines on them in a certain way and they get like this flash of light in their eyes and they look like demons, that's their pigmented epithelium. It's also another, it is part of the reason why the red eye effect occurs in cameras. So the pigmented epithelium, it mirrors light back and then it'll hit the rod and cone layer first. That rod and cone layer will emit a signal in terms of more or less glutamate to the bipolar cell layer, which will then emit a signal. Both of these are receptor potentials to the ganglion cell layer. The ganglion cell layer is the only cell layer that expresses or transmits action potentials. And that will go through the optic nerve fiber into the thalamus and then the visual cortex in the brain. So I hope that clarifies things. There will be a layer of horizontal and amacrine cells. I like to think of this layer as like the rough and fine-tuned focus on a camera. It will do something called lateral inhibition, which is responsible for sharpening the edges. As, you know, Neanderthals, we didn't really need to see colors so much as edges in movement. We needed to see when a predator was coming towards us. So hopefully that clarifies some questions in the chat. I also wanted to clarify the retinal hypothalamic path. I had some questions about this in office hours. So there are specialized ganglion cells. These are just the normal ganglion cells, your run-of-the-mill ganglion cells. There are specialized ganglion cells that will not necessarily detect patterns and color. It will just say, is it light, is it dark? It will send that signal to the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the hypothalamus, which will then sort of set the circadian rhythm in the brain. And melatonin is produced in the brain, but light suppresses the production of melatonin with that input to the suprachiasmatic nucleus. Any questions? We're feeling so confident about last week. We're pros. No, I see like no response. this is a little weird for me. Does that mean we're not pros? Like we're feeling good? Thumbs up?
All right. As good as we can.
As good as you can. All right. So you've got a little time to feel better.
Yeah.
All right. And there will be time at the end if you have any remaining questions. So now I'd like to go into today's material. The sort of learning objectives, the topics I'd like to go over are emotion, theories of emotion, expressions of emotion, my two favorite topics, which I study, fear, stress, its effect on not only the nervous system, but also the endocrine, the hormonal, and the immune system. And lastly, we'll end on a positive note, how does love affect the brain? All right, so emotion. What is the, I'm going to go over the definition. What's the difference between emotion versus feelings and universal emotions? There's many ways to define it, but emotion occurs as the result of a stimulus. It's not always directly observed, but inferred. There is sort of three levels. Cognition, which is our awareness or appraisal or evaluation of the emotion. Feeling, how we label our emotion. Action, what is our physiological arousal, or even the actions that we take. And so those three, cognition, feeling, and action. The textbook definition is a subjective mental state that is usually accompanied by distinctive behaviors, feelings, and involuntary physiological changes. What's the difference between emotions versus feelings? So emotion is like the subjective mental state, the thing that is happening within. Feeling is the label. So if we can think about what are, you know, let's say, for example, we're running, we're going for a run. Well, that's a little bit different than the subjective mental state while we're running. Like, while we're running, we're like, oh, I'm tired, or at least for me, I'm tired, or I'm flushed, or, you know, I'm having a subjective experience versus what I label it as is, well, I'm going for a run, if that makes sense. If there's any questions, please stop me. There are 8 recognized universal emotions categorized by level of intensity. And they're usually occurring in oppositional pairs. So on the medium level, in terms of intensity, we've got joy versus sadness, affection versus disgust, anger versus fear, and expectation versus surprise. There's no way to determine once and for all the number of basic emotions. They are varied and complex. But these different emotions can be detected in facial expressions that are very similar across cultures. On the higher level, we'll have, instead of anger versus fear, like rage versus terror, or instead of disgust and affection, loathing versus adoration. Instead of joy and sadness, we've got ecstasy and grief. Question?
So for that last one, expectation versus surprise, mm-hmm. I understand surprise is an emotion, but expectation, is that like excitedness, or how would that look?
I would label it as, about 2 other words to describe it on the high and low levels of intensity are vigilance and alertness. So let's say that I'm expecting a student to come and walk in person for my office hours. Not only my students come over Zoom, but let's say one student wants to come in person because they have a comfy couch. So I'm going to be a little more, I'm going to be expecting them. I'm going to be like more alert, more aware, kind of looking, listening for the knock on the door because sometimes it's soft. And, you know, sort of like feeling like I'm watching the environment more.
Is it like anticipation?
Can you say that again?
Like anticipation?
Yes, anticipation. Okay. Excellent. Yes, anticipation. Great other word to describe it. Does that clarify your question?
Yeah, yes. I just still don't understand how like that's an emotion rather than just like a cognitive like anticipation, but I'll accept it.
I think the thing with labeling these emotions is that it was determined by what facial expressions are recognized. So for example, of the facial expression of expectation or vigilance, right, can be recognized across cultures. So, you know, I agree with you. I think that the core emotions or feelings should be maybe more limited. But these are determined, the universal emotions are determined by what is recognized in facial expressions among all cultures. What can we recognize in terms of a feeling or emotion in others? Does that answer your question? Okay, great, excellent. Any other questions on this slide before we continue? Wonderful. So that's all well and good. Oh, this didn't show up on the screen very well. She's saying, she's a, you know, sci-fi person, saying there must be some rational theory. So originally we started with the folk psych, hopefully that shows up better on your computers. We originally started with the folk psychology view, which was later adapted in the James Lange theory, the Cannon-Bard theory further, that brought in the idea of cognition, and the Schachter Singer theory took some experiments and added the cognitive appraisal based on context. So, let's go into the folk psychology view. So if you're talking to a friend and they were like, I was so angry, my stomach was churning. Folk wisdom suggests that the stomach churning is caused by the anger, that the stimulus first evoked the emotion of anger or fear, and then the action came next, or the physiological arousal. Research in emotions and physiological arousal does not determine that. It's actually more subtle. It's either unclear whether or not the physiological arousal and the feeling or emotion occurs. It's unclear which occurs first. They seem to occur somewhat concurrently. Sometimes even the physiological arousal will occur first. All right, so this is adapted by William James and Carl Lang, suggesting that emotions we experience are caused by bodily changes. So my stomach is churning, therefore I must be angry. From this perspective, we experience fear, for example, because we perceive the activity that dangerous conditions trigger in our body. We have the physiological arousal, and then we put a label on top of it. However, there were several criticisms of this theory. It inspired many attempts to link specific emotions to bodily responses, like stomach turning angry, or heart racing fear. However, there's no distinctive autonomic pattern for each of these emotions. Fear and anger, for example, it's accompanied by sympathetic activation, but they somewhat overlap. So your stomach could be tight because you're angry or because you're afraid. Parasympathetic activation, the rest and digest system, tends to accompany joy and sadness, but it is unclear. You could be hungry because you are sad, or you could be hungry because you're happy and want to, have a celebration. So the role of cognition or awareness is missing in the James Lange theory. So that is also another criticism. So the two criticisms are that there's no specific autonomic pattern to the specific emotion, and the role of cognition and awareness is missing. So the Cannon-Bard theory updated the previous theory, in which the brain decides what particular motion is an appropriate response to the stimuli. So the cortex simultaneously decides on the emotional experience and activates the autonomic nervous system. This matches research more closely, in which both of these occur around the same time. So it takes in the stimuli, and it takes in sort of the surroundings, and it'll activate both the emotional experience and the autonomic nervous system, either sympathetic or parasympathetic, at the same time. So in folk psychology, the perception of the particular emotion experienced is based on the autonomic arousal. In the James Lange theory, the perception is the perception of the autonomic arousal is what the particular emotion is dependent upon. So these two are switched. In the Cannon-Bard theory, both occur at once, not one after the other. Any questions? Hi.
I think one of my classes, I remember hearing once, there's something different that happens, like when we see a bear in person versus on the TV, because we're seeing a bear either way, so how do we know which one we need to like fight or flight from, and which one we sit back? Would that fall into like the Cannon-Bard theory?
The context also decides intensity and decides type of emotion. So think of the context when you're actually seeing a bear. One time I was hiking, I was a big hiker, and I was in Yellowstone, and we didn't hide our food appropriately. We were supposed to like hang them up in a tree 50 yards away from us, and we saw a bear. Now, I don't know what I did. I think I had both at once. I think I was like, I am afraid and my heart is racing. And I, said peace to my friends and ran. I don't know if that was the right call. If I see a bear on the screen, well, that's a different context, right? I might be, if it's in a scary movie, I might be like, oh, that is scary. But I might not have the like peace out and run, reaction. I might be a little scared and not absolutely terrified.
Well, something in our brain that sees the bear doing the same threatening thing knows that it's like an actual threat or not, like
or
our consciousness.
Or the intensity of the threat, okay, based on the context, will determine the intensity of the emotion experience and the intensity of the physiological arousal. I like your question, and we're going to get to it in a couple of slides.
Okay.
Question?
I have one building off of that, but I can wait with you if we're going to get to
it. Okay, great. Excellent. All right. So, the Schachter-Singer theory was a little bit more contemporary. And by contemporary, I mean 1975. And so, basically, Schachter will assert that the emotional labels, right, that are attributed to non-specific feelings of physiological arousal, but which emotion we experience and how intense they are based on cognitive systems that assess the context, the social, physical, and psychological situation. So there were some experiments in which the subjects were injected with epinephrine. Another word for epinephrine is adrenaline, which increases the heart rate. Participants who were warned, were injecting you with adrenaline or epinephrine, you will experience an increased heart rate, reported no emotional experience. They were able to attribute what was going on physiologically to the injection. Some participants who were not forewarned experienced emotions when their bodies responded to the drug. They didn't know what drug they were being given or if they were being given anything. They were not warned. And so they had this physiological arousal that they may have attributed rather to their emotions rather than the injection itself. Plot twist, which emotion they felt could be affected by a happy or sad, they call it confederate, it's a silly word, person acting as part of the study. If there were two people in the room and one person was angry, the physiological arousal that they experienced that was not warned would be more likely to be attributed also to anger. So some participants were injected with epinephrine, but not warned of the effects. Some were. The ones that were warned did not experience an emotion. The ones that were not warned, they were not told what would happen. Some of them were exposed to another person who was filling out the survey form on what emotions they were feeling. And that person was happy and la la la. And so they maybe were reporting their physiological arousal as, I'm excited, I'm elated. Or on the flip side, other participants were exposed to an angry fellow while filling out the form, and maybe they attributed their physiological arousal to, I must be angry, that's what my arousal is due to. So these findings contradict the James Lang prediction that feelings of anger or happiness should be associated with a unique profile of autonomic reactions, right? So their physiological arousal due to the epinephrine should, according to James Lang, have resulted in a cognitive attribution of one single emotion. Schachter and Singer saw the emotional state as a result of the interaction between the physiological arousal and the cognitive interpretation of that arousal. Very importantly, this cognitive theory of emotions proposes that our interpretation of the context, context meaning environment, like actual bear versus TV bear, or other person who's happy nearby us and other person who's sad nearby us, determines which emotion we will experience as well as the level of intensity of that emotion. Did you still have a question that I didn't get a chance to answer? Was that answered by this?
No, it's kind of building off of that.
Yes, please.
I don't want to get too into the weeds, but about this fear response to seeing something and then the context affecting that, I still don't understand though, like, I mean, for example, like, it's pretty well established we have, like, a snake detector mechanism cognitively, so that even before we recognize we see something threatening like a snake, we respond emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I don't understand that, like, how would the context come before something that's so ingrained and so automatic? Like, if I were to see a snake on TV, if I were to turn the channel and see one, I'm not going to jump out of my seat.
Excellent.
I still don't understand.
Yeah, sure. Here, let's say, okay, we have a stimulus of a snake, and we feel physiological arousal. Our brains will interpret our physiological arousal as well as have an interpretation while the physiological arousal is going on, and our brains also modulate our physiological arousal. You know, if we say, oh, you know, that, you know, it's not due to the physiological arousal, I was told that the injection would make me feel a certain way. And so therefore I must not be having a certain emotion, right? And so I can quell my physiological arousal as it goes on.
Okay, so the expectation then precipitates and kind of like silences those reflexive mechanisms? Or?
Yes, and I also, I don't want to get too much into it and introduce topics that okay. I'm not going to be testing on, but for the example of fear conditioning is very dependent on context. So if you're in a context, like if I'm in the woods and I'm told I'm in Yellowstone and there are bears, right, and there's no medics nearby, I'm prepared to a certain extent to experience maybe something more intense. If I'm in a lab and they're like, we are doing a study, but you will not be harmed, I'm probably prepared to not experience as much, right? And so that modulates the preparedness due to the context will modulate not only which emotion I'm experiencing, but the intensity. Question over here.
So the notion that epinephrine is a fight or flight transmitter is really a gross oversimplification of its role.
Yes, it is. Excellent. Wonderful. So epinephrine and adrenaline are used for many different purposes. It's not necessarily, it is for fight or flight, it's for sympathetic activation, but we put the words fight and flight on it. The sympathetic activation is really, our heart is racing, our palms are sweaty, blood is being shunted away from our digestive system to our muscles, we're prepared for action. However, our brains might interpret that physiological arousal from the sympathetic nervous system due to epinephrine in many different ways. It might say, well, I'm getting ready for a race to run that I really like to win. Or it might say, I'm really angry because of the context, right? Someone's really angry at me. Or, wow, I'm really afraid there is a bear. Peace, right?
So this is like what a panic attack is, right? It's a physiological response that you don't understand, so you panic.
A panic attack is very, I'd like to get to panic, but can we table that? I would love to talk about panic because that's my jam. Question.
Could you clarify like what the difference is between this theory and the canon bar theory? Like,
yes, absolutely. Okay, so here, right, let's go back to the canon bar. So here, the sort of autonomic arousal to the stimulus and the sort of cognitive interpretation or cognitive experience is then, you know, putting a label onto and, you know, specifying the emotion or the appropriate emotional experience. So we take in two different things, the autonomic arousal and our cognitive interpretation at the same time. And that will determine which emotion we experience. It doesn't say context, it says this is an interpretation of the stimulus, right? So just the rattlesnake. So that is different than the Schachter-Singer theory in which, let me get to the thing. So it's the same thing, but the two things that are happening are we have the autonomic arousal occurring and the context. The autonomic arousal will inform the particular emotion experience that also takes into account not only an interpretation of the stimulus, but also the context.
Okay, so the canon Bard is just looking at the stimulus, but Schachter-Singer is also taking into account the context.
Yes, so think of the experiments in which they were paired with a happy or sad fellow filling out the form. The canon Bard doesn't account for that.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Question.
But the Canon Bard one with cognition, is it like how we know it's a snake and not like a hose or?
Yeah, so it's sort of like the interpretation.
Okay.
Yeah. So then the emotion will, the other aspect of this in the Schachter-Singer theory is that the emotion experience will affect future interpretations of stimuli. So let's say that I had already had pre-existing interpretations, let's say when I was a little kid and I saw a movie of a bear, and I was terrified of that bear in the movie. But then I had the autonomic arousal, I had that terror, but then I interpreted the context, I'm safe at home. And that will then later inform my future understanding of seeing a bear on TV. So it takes into account the interpretation of the context, and it also informs future experiences of the same stimuli. Question over here.
Yeah, I know attribution is a word used like when talking about emotions. Is that a word that describes like this whole process or just taking into account the context?
Yeah, so I would say that the stimulus leading to the perception of the stimulus, whether it's the autonomic arousal or a, you know, cognitive interpretation of the stimulus and context, there's no attribution there. That's just, you know, linear flows. The attribution is when we take into account the autonomic arousal and we attribute it to something based on our interpretation of the stimulus and the context.
So
does that clarify?
Is that attribution?
Yes, absolutely. Wonderful. So, any other questions? I know it's a little tricky. Excellent. Excellent. So we'll move on. If there are any questions, please feel free to stop me if you think of something later. Now I'd like to move into expression of emotion. So we have facial expressions, bodily sensations, and autonomic nervous system arousal. So the universal facial expressions are based on which emotion is interpreted similarly across many cultures without explicit training. So for example, we see this sort of the fear, the disgust, the contempt, happiness, embarrassment. We also have expectation as a facial expression that's not shown on this screen, like you were discussing. So the only two facial expressions that are not always interpreted similarly between Western and isolated non-Western cultures is surprise and disgust. So this suggests that facial expression of emotions, even though most of them are universal, there can be some cultural influence of how we interpret facial expressions in others and how we express our own emotions on our facial, by our facial expressions. So facial expressions are mediated by muscles that are informed and innervated by cranial nerves, and also deeper back, the CNS pathways that go to these cranial nerves. So the superficial facial muscles on contraction can change the shape of the mouth, eyes, or nose, whereas the deep facial muscles enables movements such as chewing, large movements of the face, the change in expression of the jaw. So these, the superficial and the deep facial muscles, are innervated by two kinds of cranial nerves. Now, if we were really evil, we would make you learn all 12 cranial nerves. We are not evil. But you only have to know two, right? So the two that are necessary to know is the fifth and the seventh cranial nerve. There is the facial nerve, which innervates the superficial muscles of facial expression. So any movement of the eyes, mouth, and nose is innervated by the facial nerve. The trigeminal nerve innervates the deep muscles that move your jaw. So chewing or frowning or something that involves big movements of the jaw. Your jaw drops in surprise, things of this nature. So there are 12, you only have to know two. These two are the two that are important for expressing emotion through our faces. There is also facial and hemispheric asymmetry. So the two cerebral hemispheres, they process emotion differently. The right hemisphere processes other people's emotions, whereas the left side is more expressive of our own emotions. So for example, if you take the facial expression, the original, and you just mirror the left side and you mirror the right side, the left side is going to be more expressive than the right. The right hemisphere reacts more quickly and more accurately, is better at interpreting facial expressions, and the right hemisphere is dominant in expressing emotions, so that's why the left side is going to be more expressive. Question?
Okay.
Can you speak up a little?
Yeah.
Data to support that, but I would infer that it's your right hemisphere that's doing the lying, and therefore you're going to look up towards the left. But I don't have data to support that answer, so that's just an inference on my own. Question? I'm sorry, speak up a little. Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back. So the right hemisphere processes other people's emotion. The left, if the right hemisphere is processing other people's emotion, that, now remember that our motor muscles, they are going to sort of, in our bodies, will flip over to the other side. And so the left side of the face, controlled by the right hemisphere, is going to be more expressive because It's processing, interpreting, and expressing emotions dominantly. Does that make sense? Think of like the right side, left side phenomena. This is not actually necessarily as binary as it seems, where like the right side is more creative and intuitive and the left side is more logical. That's not necessarily true all the time, but you know, there are some lateralizations of these types of skills.
How is the left hemisphere like different that gives us that hemisphere of asymmetry?
Well, so the right hemisphere, a good question. I would say that you know, there's specific brain regions that are lateralized. So for example, like there is the fusiform face area, which I won't go into, but that is more lateralized in the sort of the right hemisphere. So there is a little bit of fusiform face area in the left, but it's bigger in the right. Right? And so they're interpreting faces. And then they're also mirroring back their own expressions. You know, because sometimes we do take into account the context of other people's facial expressions to inform our own. Is that answering your question? I don't want to get too deep into like lateral regions that I'm not going to introduce, but just know that there are some important regions in the right hemisphere that help to dominate the interpretation and expression of emotion.
Okay, thank you.
Excellent. There is more accumulated evidence of hemispheric specialization in the processing of emotions, however, there's limited evidence of this in non-humans. So this is why this information is coming slowly, because non-human research does progress more quickly. They don't mind if we poke their brains as much. All right, so bodily sensations. There is a facial feedback hypothesis that suggests that sensory feedback from our facial expressions can affect our emotional experience. So manipulating facial expressions can alter a person's emotional experience. I don't know if any of you have experienced being upset and someone's like, don't worry, just smile, right? And then you get really upset. and then you get really, really upset. There is actually some wisdom in this, however. So, you know, there is some interesting psychological as well as Eastern philosophy teachings that the half smile can affect and change your emotions over time and can change your physiological experience. So manipulating facial expressions actually can alter your emotional experience. Any questions? All right, great. There's also emotional states that are caused in part, and we have a big role of the autonomic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight system, and the parasympathetic nervous system, which prepares the body to relax and recuperate. So there are groups of emotions that are associated with one or the other. For example, sadness and joy is part of the parasympathetic nervous system, whereas the sympathetic nervous system is more likely to be associated with anger, fear, and surprise. All right, so my favorite topic, fear. So I'd like to go over the Kluver-Busey syndrome and how that informed our understanding of the location of fear memory, and expression in the brain. Then I'd like to go over the limbic system and the amygdala, angry Amy. And finally ending with some things that I do in my own lab, which is studying what's called the predatory eminence continuum using fear conditioning parameters. So, after temporal lobectomies in monkeys. Now, remember, this was way back when, pre-70s, when they were like, let's see how unethical we can make our experiment. We don't do that anymore. So now we have ethics review boards and things. So after temporal lobectomies, so removal of the brain tissue that included the amygdala and surrounding tissue, this was actually research done to hopefully help treat epilepsy. So, you know, they found that removal of some parts of the temporal lobe did affect, you know, the epileptic seizures, and so this was research done on epilepsy. However, when they removed tissue that included the amygdala, monkeys exhibited dramatic emotional changes. They had decreased or blunted fear of humans compared to before, increased oral exploration, like eating rocks, and hypersexuality. So later experiments in monkeys and rats confirmed that targeted amygdala lesions do decrease the fear response. This confirms the amygdala is a key structure in the Kluver-Busey syndrome and a key structure in the expression of fear. So the limbic system is a series of interlinked structures associated with motivation, emotion, memory, and aggression, as well as learning. This includes the hippocampus, the seat of memories, amygdala, seat of fear, as well as some other important emotions. The hypothalamus, which is, you know, a link to the hormonal systems. The thalamus, which is the relay station. And the cingulate gyrus, which is important for alertness, self-awareness, and surprise. So the amygdala is a group of, it's actually not one structure. We term it as one unit and one structure. It's not. It's a group of nuclei with different types of cells, different sort of functions that are in the medial interior part of the temporal lobe. These nuclei is the seat of the key structure involved in fear. It's located at the anterior medial portion of the temporal lobe, so really deep down in there. It's a little almond shape. It's comprised of 12 different nuclei, each with a distinct set of connections. I am not evil. I will not make you memorize all 12. However, I will say that the central nucleus of the amygdala is really important for regulating blood pressure and the freezing behavior in response to conditioned fear stimulus. So there's been a lot of research done on what's called the central nucleus of the amygdala, or sometimes you'll see it termed as the central amygdala. Amygdala damage in animals, with the Kluver-Busey syndrome, as well as further fear research, results in tameness, impaired fear conditioning, lack of freezing when they see or smell a predator. So, you know, you see this mouse and this cat, this mouse has had an amygdala lesion, he don't care. So the amygdala damage renders animals indifferent to what's called species-specific predatory cues. So normally the mouse will react in fear to even just the smell of a cat. However, in this case, this will not occur. Additionally, let's take a different species. The monkey is even in the vision of a toy snake will cause the monkey to react. However, here, this monkey is just chilling, he don't care. So there's also a disruption of normal social behavior. So there's an important social role for the amygdala. We do know a lot about the neural basis of this emotion because all that we have been able to model in non-humans. So don't agree with the ethics of previous 70s research. However, we have been able to make great advances based on animal research. Now, let's take this and apply it to amygdala damage in humans. A very important patient, SM, not HM, SM, had a very rare genetic disorder in which calcium deposits accumulated in the amygdala, eventually destroying it in both hemispheres. This patient had a lack of fear response overall, as well as an inability to recognize facial expressions in other people, especially fear expressions. So other people, in addition to patient HM with amygdala damage, are very impaired in recognizing facial expressions. As we can see in this graph, on the right side here, that the sort of the like most like likely for these patients to not be able to recognize is fear. So they also exhibit abnormal social interaction. So a study using patient HM who had bilateral damage in the amygdala used eye tracking software to show that patient SM had difficulty fixating on eyes to process facial expressions. Now I'd like to go over what we do in our lab. I work for Dr. Michael Fanslow at UCLA, who is one of probably five international experts on the neurobiology of fear and post-traumatic stress disorder. Michael Fanslow's predecessor, Robert Bowles, was the gentleman who coined the term fight, flight, freeze in the autonomic system arousal. Michael went a step further and created the predatory eminence continuum, which answers the question of how do we choose between defensive behaviors? How do we choose between fight, flight, freeze, or maybe approach avoid, things of this nature? So this theory states that the choice of behaviors is dependent upon the quote-unquote distance from the threat. This distance could be physical, so space, it's far away, not up close. Temporal, right? The exam is, you know, next Thursday, so we don't have to panic about it until next Wednesday. Psychological, right? The sense that this is really imminent and affecting our lives versus it's far away and not affecting us as much. So let's take the example of what we model in animals. When it's further away from the predator, it will exhibit its preferred behavior. It's gonna go munching on its chow, and it's gonna like make a nest and take a nap. When it sees the predator from far away, or maybe even gets a whiff of a small amount of the predator's odor, it will engage in what's called approach-avoid behaviors. And it's actually really cute on the screen. You see the little mousey like do this like thing where he's like sort of popping his head out and like stretching out. He's like trying to like sort of get a lay of the land. He does this little like sway thing. He's like, you know, really cute. When it experiences the encounter, and that means that the animal is either up close or there's a very strong odor that can't be denied, or, you know, maybe it's, you know, has had an unpleasant experience in the lab in some way, then afterwards it will engage in freezing behaviors. Maybe the animal takes a swipe, or maybe somehow the animal is physically affected by the predator, and the predator is up close, then the animal will engage in fight-flight behaviors. Why is it so important to match these behaviors with psychological or temporal or spatial distance? Well, if not, the cat wins, it gets eaten, point of no return. These phases are called the preferred or baseline behavior, the pre-encounter phase, the post-encounter phase, and circus strike, and then this phase is just called you lose. So this maps onto human states of anxiety, fear, and panic. For example, when I am low-level anxious but not quite afraid, I might engage in avoidance behaviors. I might procrastinate on that studying because I don't want to feel anxious. Let's say the exam is, you know, right in front of me or coming up soon. God forbid, I have so much to study. I'm gonna just not do anything and take a nap. Well, now I'm really afraid. I'm freezing. Let's say that it's, you know, I don't know if you have this experience. Let's say that you're taking the exam or you're about to take the exam and you dream of running away to, you know, an ashram far away from this educational experience, and maybe you'll just be a yoga teacher because, you know, never mind. I don't know if you have those thoughts. I do. So now we've modeled these in the animals with the hope of applying this research to humans. So long ago, it was important for us to run from saber-toothed tigers. Now, we might see maladaptive behavior in running from our boss or something else. So, for example, anxious people will be more, or people with anxiety disorders will be more likely to engage in avoidance behavior. People with panic disorder will engage in a lot of fight-flight behaviors. Another thing about panic disorders is that it's a vicious cycle in which the fear cue becomes internal. Panic disorder is characterized by a very strong interpretation of physiological arousal. So it's, well, I'm breathing heavy, so therefore I must be afraid, but now I'm afraid that I'm breathing heavy because what if I don't stop breathing, and then you get more afraid, and the interpretation of the physiological arousal in context becomes increasingly extreme. So it's a vicious upward cycle of arousal. So we also have, hi, question.
So then when you have a panic attack, a lot of the times one of the symptoms is you feel like you're gonna die, or
yes,
like you're worried you're gonna die. Is that a response to the physiological symptoms and not the actual, like, even though a lot of people attribute it to because they're afraid of something that's happening?
Sure.
Is it actually just a response to how you're physiologically responding?
I would say, like, it is a response to both, but it is heavily informed by the negative interpretation of the physiological arousal. So, you know, it will be attributed to context in some cases. Or, you know, in other cases, it really depends on whether or not it's pure panic disorder, if it's like trauma-informed panic. But in the case of just like a phobia, pure panic disorder, then it'll be a very negative interpretation of physiological arousal. And somewhat informed by context, it'll be more attributed to context. So, for example, some student is in my office and having a panic attack. Well, their heart starts racing. They start breathing heavily. Then they go, oh my God, my heart is racing. Someone without panic disorder might be like, it'll calm down, right? I'm like a little like upset, but I'll be fine. Someone with panic disorder goes, I'm having a heart attack, right? I really must be having a heart attack. And it really is very real, right? And so, but they don't get from 0 to 60 right away. It's an upward spiral of, there must be something wrong because my heart is racing. I can't stop my heart racing. What if I can't control it? And it just keeps going up the negative spiral of cognitive interpretations. There can also be an upward spiral of interpretation of context. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah,
everyone's panic disorder is different. So, you know, there can be some unifying themes. However, you know, different people experience, you know, different levels of cognitive interpretations. All right, excellent. So now we've got the predatory imminence continuum, in which the pre-encounter or anxiety is based on potential threat, post-encounter or fear is based on definitely detected threat, and circus strike behavior or panic is based on contact with the threat or perceived contact with the threat. So remembering that the distance from the threat can be spatial, temporal, or psychological. It can be, you know, you can psychologically interpret a threat as more imminent. All right, so how do we study this in the lab? Well, we use a paradigm called fear conditioning. Fear conditioning is a type of classical conditioning when a previously neutral stimulus, let's say a tone, is repeatedly paired with an unpleasant experience. Like in the lab, we use these grid floors with a light foot shock. Now, I put my hand on these grid floors, they are equivalent to a dryer shock. We do like attenuate it based on the animal's weight so that it does look like a little experienced as a dryer shock. However, even a dryer shock is very unpleasant, especially if you're in a weird lab with weird people in coats and doing weird things to you and putting you in boxes. So the repetition of the pairing of the tone and the light foot shock causes the subject to eventually freeze in response. This freezing in response is the conditioned response to the stimulus. So now the neutral stimulus becomes what's called the conditioned stimulus, the CS. So pairing the sound with a painful experience will cause freezing behavior even just after a period of repetition and time. You can put the animal back in the box and play the tone, and it will freeze just to the tone even without the presence of a shock, because now it's attributed negative experiences to the tone. So, in a classical conditioning procedure, the tone is associated with like a mild shock. So here, the tone is just being played. Its blood pressure, which is also indicative of the amount of freezing, will raise just slightly. Just sort of like, oh, this is new. There's a tone. I've never heard that before. So that might be surprise. Now, let's say that the tone is paired with a light foot shock. The animal will like do a little hop, like popcorn, and afterwards will just jump back down and freeze. So the blood pressure will then spike and it will engage in freezing behaviors. Over time and repetition, the tone alone elicits these responses. However, in fear conditioning, there's very little repetition required. It can take a pairing of maybe 1 to 3 times for the animal to fear condition, as well as 24 hours. So let's say that in one day it's paired 1 time tone and shock, or up to 3 times tone and shock. You put it, you know, back in its little vivarium and it goes back with its friends. Bring it back the next day, back in the box, play the tone, it will freeze. So in terms of Pavlovian fear conditioning, what I do in the lab is I will pair a tone with a light foot shock, and I'm going to look at what happens in two nuclei of the amygdala. One is called the basal lateral amygdala, and it's termed because it's in the base and lateral side. And the basal lateral amygdala is actually, the lateral amygdala is incredibly important for synaptic and neuroplasticity. So brain plasticity occurs very strongly in the amygdala. And there will be an input of the aversive stimulus into the lateral amygdala and an input of the conditioned stimulus into the lateral amygdala, and it will form that association and form a very strong synapse and response. I'm not going to go into the nuts and bolts of neuroplasticity because I'm not mean. However, knowing that the lateral amygdala is a seat of very important emotional neuroplasticity can be important. Another place in which we've learned a lot about brain plasticity is the hippocampus, where we store our memories. The central nucleus of the amygdala is responsible for eliciting these fear-like responses, such as blood pressure, freezing. So for example, if the central nucleus of the amygdala is removed and nothing else, the animal will not freeze in response to fear. What I study is a brain region that actually connects the amygdala to downstream structures such as the hypothalamus or the brainstem, called the periaqueductal gray region. The periaqueductal gray connects the amygdala to the hypothalamus and motor neurons, and as well as regions in the brainstem. Why am I studying this? Well, the ventral region of the periaqueductal gray, that's so long, I'm just gonna call the PAG. The ventral region of the PAG is actually responsible for eliciting flight behaviors, whereas the dorsal region is responsible for eliciting the circus strike escape behaviors. So we've got the post-encounter freezing in the ventral portion. We've got the circus strike fight flight in the dorsal portion. I'm studying, how does that seesaw occur? At what point are these two centers talking to each other to determine the appropriate fear response? Why is this important to me? Well, these sort of seesaws, or these sort of thresholds with which you enter from anxiety to fear, fear to panic, can become very dysregulated, not only in anxiety and panic disorders, but also, very importantly, post-traumatic stress disorder. Question.
You said the ventral is for responsible for eliciting flight?
Freezing.
Yes. And then dorsal is for flight?
Flight. That won't be tested. Anything that's not on the slides won't be tested. I'm just telling you because I like to geek out over it.
No, it's cool.
All right. So, let's talk about stress. We're all experts, right? The three aspects I'd like to discuss are the importance of adaptation and coping in stress, stress in the medial prefrontal cortex, as well as abnormal psychology in response to stress. Stress mobilizes adaptation and coping. A stressor is any circumstance that upsets homeostatic balance. After the initial response to the stress, there is what's called adaptation, which restores homeostatic balance. Exhaustion is the reaction to prolonged stress. So, you know, there is sort of a sweet spot in terms of stress and performance that I like to talk about with my students all the time. You want to be anxious in the middle, right? You don't want to be not anxious so much that it doesn't mobilize you to take action, but you don't want to be so fearful that your amygdala hijacks your brain and your prefrontal cortex just shuts down. So, the sweet spot of stress and performance. Newer research shows that the medial areas of the prefrontal cortex are extremely sensitive to even brief stressors, especially if they are unpredictable. If the prefrontal cortex is compromised, our ability to inhibit emotional responses to future stressors is weakened. Before I came to UCLA, I worked at the NYU Emotional Brain Institute, where I studied the medial prefrontal cortex in response to developmental trauma. Developmental trauma actually deeply affects the inhibition or the modulation of deeper brain structures in the amygdala and in the limbic system from the prefrontal cortex. So it becomes much more disorganized and less likely to attenuate or inhibit emotional responses downstream. So it does, developmental trauma, we confirm, does compromise the ability to inhibit emotional responses. And we were also working on drugs that might be able to strengthen or, strengthen the neuroplasticity in those regions. So in depression, abnormal levels of the stress hormone cortisol are experienced. So you would think that depressed patients don't experience any stress because their affect is so low. And because in sadness, you are mostly in the parasympathetic part of your nervous system. However, there are very, very high levels of cortisol, even not in reaction to stress, just constantly in the patient with depression. So there is an important role of stress and depression. There are also studies by, originally, now Martin Seligman is the president of the American Psychological Association. I'm just telling you this because I'm a geek. He did studies on what's called learned helplessness. So the idea with learned helplessness is if the animal is exposed to inescapable stress for a prolonged period of time, even if that escape is now allowed, if the door is now opened and they can escape from stress, they will do nothing. They'll just sit there. And this really closely models depression. And the idea in depression that, you know, there is a sense of learned helplessness, there's nothing I can do to escape stress, as well as a decreased internal locus of control in depressed patients. So the studies by Martin Seligman in learned helplessness made him very well known. He created at UPenn a Center for Positive Psychology and now is the president of the American Psychological Association. I'm not going to go into learned helplessness too much, but that's an interesting tidbit about depression. So what I study is post-traumatic stress disorder. This was first known in the 50s, 60s, and 70s to diagnose war veterans coming back from war. The brain regions that we see are affected is a hyper, meaning like overactive, amygdala, and a hypo, prefrontal cortex, meaning underactive, hypo. So the executive functioning is reduced. There's also reduced memory or hippocampus size. So there's less, you know, relative memory. Some features of post-traumatic stress disorder include hyper arousal, so like hypervigilance, you can't sleep. Impaired extinction of the habitual stress response. So extinction means that when the stress is removed, and you still have the fear cue, over time you'll realize it's no longer a fear cue. Over time, let's say the animal who has been paired with tone and shock, it will go in the box and it'll just play the tone over and over again without the shock. Eventually the animal learns that the tone is no longer dangerous. It no longer means shock and it will slowly over time stop freezing or stop doing its preferred fear-like behavior. That is not true in patients with post-traumatic stress disorder. They struggle to extinguish fear cues. They will re-experience traumatic events, and they will avoid anything that might bring up the memory of the stress. I want to point out, question before I move on.
So the anatomic changes that you described, the amygdala, the prefrontal cortex, those are growth findings that are consistent?
Yes, I mean, obviously, PTSD is a spectrum disorder, so some people have more severe or less severe post-traumatic stress. So therefore, their anatomical changes will be in proportion to where they are along the spectrum. However, in let's say very, very, you know, strong, severe post-traumatic stress disorder, there is an incredibly hyper-responsive amygdala. Actually, this is really interesting. Our lab has done studies on this that there is anatomical changes in the glutamate signaling in the amygdala. So the glutamate actually will bind, and because it's so used to being excited from the stress, now the amygdala has created these anatomical responses where it will always result in a very strong response so that the brain doesn't constantly have to emit so much glutamate. And so as a result, it's a very hyperactive, hypersensitive region in response to any kind of excitation because the receptors have changed to elicit stronger and stronger responses. The prefrontal cortex is smaller and hyporesponsive because it'll basically over time the prefrontal cortex will elicit less inhibitory signals like let's say GABA or things of that nature because The brain needed to be on guard. It didn't need the inhibition during that stress or that time of prolonged stress. So there are anatomical changes. And the reduced hippocampal size, we are not clear on why that occurs. So more fun to come as we do more research. but yes, there are, based on the severity of their disorder, there will be very gross anatomical changes. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Awesome. Great questions. All right. So I want to point out every time that post-traumatic stress is approached in a lecture that it's always with regards to war veterans. We know that this is not true. Civilian post-traumatic stress disorder in some ways is actually more difficult to treat than veteran post-traumatic stress disorder. Why? Because the danger and safety cues get mixed up. So in veterans, they know that war is dangerous. They're prepared for danger. In civilian post-traumatic stress, they might not be prepared. There might be some violence that occurs in their safe, otherwise safe neighborhood or some such. So there are some important health disparities in terms of this. Now, whether or not they have more severe post-traumatic stress symptoms can be affected by age. The younger they are, the more likely they are to develop post-traumatic stress responses because they don't have as many coping mechanisms at that age. The intensity of the stress, so the more violent it is, or the more, you know, it affects your homeostatic balance, as well as the chronicity, the more chronic the stress is. So that will likely result in PTSD development and symptomology as the intensity and the what's called the chronicity or the repetition increases. So I always like to talk about this. Interestingly, not only are females more likely to experience trauma, they're also more likely to go on from that trauma to develop post-traumatic stress. Why? Well, because there are some sex differences in our nervous system. Females are actually more primed to more strongly react to changes in the environment. So therefore, if there's a predator, they will be the first to detect it. They will be the first to protect their young and to alert others to mobilize. Let's say when we were hunter-gatherers and there was a saber-toothed tiger. So females actually, evolutionarily, from the maternal instinct, are more primed to react strongly to changes in the environment. This actually makes them more likely to go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder in response to trauma. Additionally, they also experience more civilian trauma. Interestingly, it has been proposed that since PTSD occurs more frequently in Hispanic or Black communities, that therefore they're more likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. I'd like to amend this. This is not quite true. They are more likely to experience trauma in their communities as a result of societal imbalance. However, they're equally likely from the trauma, if you take the same group and, you know, the same culture and different cultures and background, different race, it's all equally likely to go on to develop post-traumatic stress if you take the same level of trauma and the same level of stress. So I did want to amend that. Sometimes there's misinformation. Okay, so let's keep going. How does stress or fear affect the endocrine and immune system in addition to the nervous system? The alarm reaction is the initial response to the stress. The hypothalamus activates the sympathetic nervous system, and that stimulates the adrenal medulla, so that is a part of our kidneys, the gland in our kidneys, and it also stimulates the anterior pituitary gland, which is right behind the hypothalamus in our brains. The pituitary gland links the hypothalamus to the bloodstream. Hormones secreted by the adrenal medulla, such as epinephrine or norepinephrine, i.e. adrenaline or noradrenaline, are under the control of the sympathetic nervous system, and cortisol is secreted by the anterior pituitary gland. So adrenaline, noradrenaline, kidneys, cortisol, the brain, pituitary gland. So under stress, the hypothalamus activates the sympathetic nervous system to cause a fight or flight response. So this response will the fast response will be the adrenal medulla releasing epinephrine and norepinephrine. This is fast acting in that it boosts heart rate, breathing, and other physiological processes for action. We also have the slow response in which the hypothalamus stimulates the anterior pituitary to release cortisol. What does cortisol do? It's slower acting, but basically it shifts the energy stores in the body. It'll shunt away energy from the digestive system towards the muscles. So cortisol is the slow response, whereas adrenaline and noradrenaline from the kidney glands is the fast response. Levels of epinephrine and norepinephrine correlate with self-reported levels of stress, such as, in this example in Part A, normal versus crowded trains. I assume they're in a city where crowded trains are annoying. Or even exam-related hormonal changes. So here at day zero is the exam, and you see the nice spike of epinephrine and norepinephrine here. You see the slow increase of both as the exam, as it gets closer to the exam, and then whoo, afterwards the nice lovely adrenaline crash. Question.
I think on the previous slide it said like the adrenal cortex releases cortisol, but then on a different side it said the anterior pituitary.
Okay, yeah, great question. Cortisol. So I want to clarify this. So basically what happens is the pituitary gland doesn't immediately respond to signals from the brain. It takes in signals from the brain, and then once norepinephrine and epinephrine hit the pituitary gland, then it will release cortisol. Does that make sense? So like it needs two signals to elicit, but cortisol, let's clarify, cortisol is definitely released from the anterior pituitary, and I apologize, this word choice is terrible, and I will edit it for more clarity, so there's no questions here. But yes, cortisol is released from the anterior pituitary gland. However, the pituitary waits for two signals. It waits for a brain signal, like I am stressed, and it waits for the fast reacting epinephrine and norepinephrine. And then it will release cortisol.
Okay, thank you.
Does that answer your question? Clarify? This word choice is terrible.
Okay.
Question.
Isn't there a hormone called ACTH?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Excellent. So we've got ACTH, which I believe stands for something adrenal cortical something like stimulating hormone. And so basically, what happens is the pituitary gland will release the adrenal stimulant. So first, let's go in steps. Right. Step one, the brain is like, I am stressed. Step two. The pituitary gland releases the adrenal stimulating hormone. Step three, the adrenals will release norepinephrine and epinephrine. Step four, there will be two signals coming into the pituitary because it's linked into the bloodstream that are like, oh, wow, my body is reacting to stress with norepinephrine and epinephrine as well as brain signals. Then it will release cortisol. So you are correct. We've got two signals coming first, right? I'm focusing on step three and step four. But great question. Yes, precisely. Any other questions on this? The hormonal system can be tricky. All right, great. So we've got our exam-related hormonal response, like the midterm you just took, or even anything associated with my PhD. So here, we also have chronic stress issues. So these fast and slow hormonal responses, so the epinephrine, the norepinephrine, the cortisol, it can be sustained under prolonged stress. What happens with some of these stress hormones? Well, the stress hormones will shut down the immune system. It'll shunt attention and energy stores away from the immune system, away from digestion, and it will go to muscles or the brain or things that prepare us for reactions. So, for example, you'll see here there are stressors, could be anything from social stress to toxins, and the body defense systems will now start to shunt, right, energy towards the nervous system for memory, perception, coping, appraisal, for activating our motor neurons, things of this nature, and the immune system will inform it, but it also can be shut down by the endocrine factors and start to get the immune response to pathogens can get lower and lower. So let's go into the immune response. Your immune system fights disease-causing germs, pathogens, like bacteria, viruses, parasites, or fungi, and removes them from the body. Now, it can recognize and neutralize harmful substances, also like to fight disease-causing changes in the body, such as cancer cells. There's a lot of research done on the natural killer cells in the immune system and how it can be used and manipulated to better fight cancer and the spread of cancer. The brain affects the immune system through the autonomic nerves, and it does monitor and regulate immune reactions. So the immune system also acts as a sensory receptor system, so it has an input and an output, informing the brain. So its input informs the brain of any pathogens or stressors to the immune system and body, but also has an output based on the nervous system and the endocrine system. So two important immune system cells are antibodies. So these are large proteins used in your immune system to attack foreign particles. So there'll be proteins that like stick to the foreign particles and, you know, signal to the macrophages like, come eat me. So this is actually what COVID-19 home tests look for. This is different than the PCR test where they look for genetic material of the virus. Cytokines are proteins that induce the growth of cells in the immune systems are very important in the inflammatory response, such as swelling, fever, you know, any kind of tenderness around a wound, things of that nature. So stress can produce a decline in the number of immune cells as well as in levels of cytokines. Even the perception of stress can decrease the number of antibodies produced to fight illness. Adrenal steroid hormones, as well as cortisol, released during stress, can suppress the immune system. This acts as a short-term defense mechanism, so it allows resources to be used elsewhere, but long-term stress is detrimental to immune function. So let's take a poll. How many of you have gotten sick during midterms? Yeah, okay, there we go. How many of you have gotten sick during finals? Yeah, okay, so that tracks. All right, excellent. But this is what's happening in your body, that your stress hormones are actually suppressing your immune system function. So let's get to, we've discussed a lot of very serious topics, like post-traumatic stress disorder, fear, things that are not as happy. So let's end on a good note. Love on the brain. fMRI scans show differences in brain activation when viewing photographs of a loved one versus platonic friends. It increases activity in the insula, and the insula is very interesting. It's a part of the cortex that is responsible for interoceptive awareness. So you might actually even hear the word like insula, like by a meditation or a yoga teacher. They're always talking about insula and the vagus nerve. So insula is the like sense of oneself in one's body. So it increases activity in this region, as well as the anterior cingulate cortex, which is the cingulate cortex, as I said before, is responsible for alertness and surprise systems. The anterior portion is responsible for just general like standing to attention, alertness, like the thing, it gets activated when you're studying, for example. However, this reduces activity in the amygdala, so there is an important component of social buffering in fear and stress, as well as reduced activity in the posterior cingulate, which is responsible for, it is an alertness system, but it's the more severe one. It's the like surprise and, you know, oh no, what's going on? There is the sort of like, it stimulates sort of these like red alarms and coordinates very closely with the amygdala. So here, love increases activity in the insula, so the sense of oneself and one's body, as well as like alertness or, you know, like a attention focus, and reduces activity in the fear and surprise and panic systems. So from the old lab I worked at NYU, we actually studied maternal buffering in response to stress, that mothers who were very affectionate with their young and had lots of resources to make them a nice nest, and, you know, were very, very, like, sort of emotive and, like, very, you know, meeting their needs, resulted in much lower stress responses and lower cortisol levels in their young that lasted well into adulthood. And there was actually increased activity in the posterior cingulate and the amygdala and decreased activity in the insula and anterior cingulate cortex. So there's such an important component for social support and love and connection in response to dealing with and handling stress and fear. Any questions? Wonderful. So, other emotions While it's difficult to pinpoint a single region responsible for a single emotion. In fact, there has even been a lot of conflict in the industry about whether or not we should pinpoint the amygdala in response to fear. The amygdala activates a variety of other brain regions, such as the medial prefrontal cortex. It activates the posterior cingulate cortex. Will activate what's called the striatum, which is a region of the brain responsible for procedural and muscle control. Further downstream, it'll activate the hypothalamus. It'll activate the periaqueductal gray region. So many emotions are not necessarily tied to one specific brain region. Rather, it's a network of specific activations in multiple brain regions. So you can see here on the right-hand side, we've got sadness, right? So sort of the red and yellow indicate areas of increased activity. And then the, you know, purple indicates decreased activity here. So, you know, we see here we've got increased activity in the the anterior cingulate cortex and the amygdala, as well as the dorsal pons, which is an area that affects breathing, happiness. We've got sort of this decreased activity in the anterior cingulate, but increased in the left insula and posterior, fear, anger, so on and so forth. So, in summary, I always like to include a scheme at the end of my lecture so you can kind of have a nice hierarchy outline of the topics. I hope it's not too overwhelming. It really is meant to help you in your studies. So emotion, we discussed the definition of emotion, the difference of feelings versus emotions, and the 8 universal emotions. In theories, we discussed the differences between folk psychology, that the autonomic, the emotion affects the autonomic system. We have talked about the James Lang theory, and I'm not done with my portion just yet, so no need to rush out of class. We're gonna have an activity after this. We have the Cannon-Bard theory, which takes in both the stimuli as well as the autonomic arousal, and the Schachter-Singer theory, which takes into account like how we attribute and how we appraise things cognitively based on context as well as the stimulus and autonomic arousal. We talked about the expressions of emotion in terms of facial expressions, bodily sensations, and the autonomic nervous system. Fear, I discussed the Kluver-Busey syndrome, what happens when the amygdala is removed, the role of the limbic system and the amygdala, the predatory imminence continuum, and fear conditioning in our lab. In terms of stress, we discussed adaptation and coping, stress and how it affects the medial prefrontal cortex, as well as abnormal psychology. We discussed the hormone response in terms of chronic stress, as well as the immune response, and we ended on love. So anything that I discussed verbally will not be tested. It's all going to be from the slides. Things I discussed verbally is just me geeking out, and I can't help it. So now I'd like to ask for, are there any questions? Hi.
You mentioned the changes that occur as a result of maternal state of mind. What can you say about the challenge years of life? Are they like this, or are they different?
So let's take the example of the low-resourced mother, that mother who's stressed and doesn't have as much bedding to build a nest, and maybe there's like noise in the environment and things of that nature. She's going to be less likely to attend to her young. These young will grow up to have an increased cortisol response to the same stressor as compared to the pups who maybe had a more maternally nurturing environment, right? So this is compared to the high-resourced mother who, you know, has a very lovely area, lots of, you know, nest stuff to build a nest, very attentive to her young because there's little stress in the environment. And so the low-resourced mother, those pups will have an increased cortisol response as compared to the high-resourced pups. They'll have an increased, sort of amygdala response. And they will have, increased activity in their amygdala and posterior cingulate, and a lower activity in their insula and anterior cingulate in comparison to the high-resource pups. Additionally, they are more likely to go on to develop anxiety disorders, as well as avoidance, sort of show like avoidance behaviors as compared to the high resource pups. Yeah, so there's a really, and then there's also research done, which I wasn't a part of, done on like buffering socially in adulthood within a colony, for example. So that also has important components on the brain regions and stress.
But those effects can be moderated by neuroplasticity later?
Yeah, so that's a great question. They can be influenced by social buffering in adulthood, right? So communities, right, that have a lot of resources where the animal, I mean, again, this is animal models, so there's only so much, you know, things that we can do, but like, you know, they have a lovely colony to play in and, you know, running wheels and blocks, and they have friends, and they're in a social enriched, what's called an enriched environment. That can definitely have very rescuing influences on them, not only the resource enrichment, but as well as the social enrichment. And, you know, there's also other research being done on what can we do pharmacologically. But yes, so does that answer your question?
Sounds like a good argument for Head Start.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent, great. All right, so now what I'd like to do is, we did discuss a little bit about the extra credit for the sort of evaluations being done. I'd like to pause here and give you a moment to complete those evaluations if you have not already done so. So please open your emails, try to complete these evaluations while we're here in class.